Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Welcome to Real Recovery. It's Big Night. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio. George Fraser on the other side. Big Night, George. Big Night.
Big Night.
Big Night. We get bringing in the big guns tonight.
It was real smooth, the whole show. This guy is interesting. It's a little different tonight for us, Bill.
Well, it is. We had a chance to talk to Dr. Marv Seppala. He is the chief medical doctor at the Betty Ford Hazleton Clinic. And we kind of did this interview a little bit in reverse. We've already spoken to him, and now we're adding in the beginning of the show because unlike George and me, he's a very important guy on a very busy schedule. And we only had a limited amount of time with him.
You know what we should have done?
What?
We could have acted like the thing was after and like we had like some prophecy going that we knew what was coming. And
yeah, we could have.
But people who know us would know that was staged. A very interesting show. And what we want to talk about real quickly, there's a couple things if you're listening tonight that are going to be different. We're not going to go with a setup on the breaks. A lot of them are real sharp. We just go to them. And the reason is we didn't want to cut anything out to fit our format. And as Bill said, we normally do this segment first and then the interview. But we were able to get this doctor on our show that we wanted to. So things are different with us tonight. Roll with it because it's worth it. We want to start off with step one, Bill, which is we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and our life's unmanageable. And I think tonight's story shows that if you suit up and show up, God takes care of the rest.
Let's say more about step one, George.
I thought I just spoke for a
lot. Yeah. Can you fill a little more time on step one?
Yeah. Finish the donut while I keep going here. We think we are in charge and everything is our doing and it's the result of our actions. And what happens in step one? We realize that our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God, meaning God is in control of everything. And when we turn our life and will over to God instead of fighting that, it goes a lot better. And God has a plan for our life, not just to get you to stop using or drinking. He wants you to have a relationship with Him, and part of that is to help you with your problems so you can go take to other people what He did for you and share that. And that's actually the best part of our lives, I think.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Marv Seppala, our guest tonight, did share quite a story of recovery, and you would think that we've heard it all at this point after almost 7 years of doing the show, but tonight changes that narrative. This is quite a story, George.
Well, you know, when we say we've heard it all, we think we do, and I was thinking, boy, there I go limiting God again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think I've heard it all, seen it all, and know it all, and that's why I'm stuck where I am. But I think we minimize that. This story is truly incredible, and after doing it 7 years, is that what we're doing? This rate's up there is, you got to be kidding me, story.
Yeah, it is. I think we said that more than once. You got to be kidding me.
Yep.
And so you're going to be absolutely fascinated. And just to also reiterate what George just said, we did run the interview kind of without any breaks, so it's not going to have the normal ins and outs. It's going to sort of end abruptly, but it'll resume exactly where we left off. So it will give you a chance just to hear the whole interview, and you're just going to want to hang in there with us because it's one you're not going to want to miss. This is really, I have to say, George, this caught me by surprise.
Yeah,
and
me too.
And also his expertise, as what we talked about in the second half of the hour on opioid addiction, really applies to anybody and everybody. Even if you've never been a drug or alcohol person, maybe you're going to have a shoulder surgery or dental work, and you're going to need some pain meds, and you never know how it's going to affect you.
You certainly won't, and you might be in recovery a long time and have to have something like this, and you're going to be shocked how powerful it is, and there's a part of you that enjoys it. And so tonight, I learned a lot, and it's just very interesting show. I got a lot of hope out of it, Bill.
I got a lot of hope, too. I mean, I think Marv is going to demonstrate to all of us that it doesn't really matter how you start or where things are for you in life, there's always a tomorrow and there's always going to be hope and there's always going to be a chance for a fresh beginning.
Absolutely. So, and you go to the top of the treatment world and you start out at the bottom of the addiction world.
Yeah.
And only God can do that.
Yeah, and another thing I found interesting is he's got that soothing voice. He could be a DJ on a late-night jazz show.
I thought he was the bass player for Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Ah, he sounds like he could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a little bit of that sound.
Yeah, it was very fun to do, but you will learn a lot, and you're going to be your hope is going to be renewed when you listen to
So you've heard of the Betty Ford Clinic and Hazleton. They've joined forces, and Dr. Marv Seppala is the chief medical officer. So that's what's in store for us tonight on Real Recovery. I'm awfully glad that you are listening, as is George. So we'll take a little break, and then when we return, we'll be joined by Dr. Marv Seppala. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way. George P. Fraser, a man who lounges so hard it actually became his full-time job. Hello, George.
Hey, Billy.
We've got a great guest tonight. Dr. Marv Seppala is with us tonight. He's the chief medical officer at Hazleton Betty Ford. I suppose we can do better than that.
It's really going to be an interesting show. Hazleton has the biggest influence on recovery, I believe, in the world, and we look around at the treatment centers, the people, you know, the retreat, John Curtis, Saul Selby, people that are in the business. Almost everybody has a Hazleton connection, so I'm really looking forward to this.
So, Marv, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say, I'm fascinated beyond belief with your story, and it starts with you as a young boy, 15 or so, getting involved in drugs and alcohol, dropping out of high school.
It does. Actually, at 12 with alcohol and drugs by 15 and treatment by 17. Dropping out of high school as a senior at 17 and actually ending up at Hazleton.
Yeah, so how do you go from being an alcoholic drug addict at 12, 15, dropping out of high school to become the chief medical officer at Hazleton? That is just I can't make that connection.
Well, I just stayed there the entire time, giving me better and better jobs. I got sober at 19, so I didn't go off to college right away. After I went through high school graduation without a diploma, they allowed me to see my teachers in the evenings, and that didn't work out because I was using and didn't show up. But later, I lost a few jobs, and I ended up applying to be a janitor at the Mayo Clinic. You know, IBM and Mayo are the biggest employers in Rochester, and I'd gone through a few jobs. I never lost a job. I just wouldn't show back up. And so I'd get some money and just go get high and screw off. And So I applied at Mayo to be a janitor. They didn't have a job and sent me away. But 2 weeks later, they called my home phone, my parents' phone. That my parents had disowned me after I had been in treatment and then returned to use. And they decided that was enough and probably a good decision. I'm the oldest of five, and I wasn't doing anything to help my siblings out at all. They called my mother. She found my girlfriend, who found me. I was living out of my car at the time in Rochester, luckily in the summer. And I went in for an interview, and they sent me over to a cardiovascular research lab where I was hired as a lab technician. Now, I can only say that I was being taken care of long before I cared at all about myself, because I was still using at the time. I was just kind of fumbling along, barely making it, not even having my own apartment or anything. I couldn't pull enough money together for that sort of thing. And then here I was suddenly working under two world-famous researchers at the Mayo Clinic. And that job got me thinking that I'd better do something about my life. It was just so remarkable, so stimulating, being around those people. All kinds of fellows from all over the world came to work under the two guys, Dr. John Shepherd and David Donald, and They were young docs in fellowships, kind of trying to learn how to be researchers, and they kept, you know, asking me what I was going to do with my life, and they had no idea about the drug addiction. I didn't dare say anything. It was a surgical lab. There was all kinds of drugs available, and I didn't want to get fired. I wanted that job.
You know, that's really amazing because, Bill, it doesn't sound like recovery was an idea that we wanted to do, and God allows him to go into a place where he can see that there's something in his life that he wants. He just shows up to get a job, and he meets some people that are productive people, you know, doing important things, and God touches his heart with that. It's amazing.
It is, Marv, because I'm trying to picture you at, I don't know how old you are at this point. Are you 19 or 20?
At that point, I thought you meant now. I'm 61.
No, I know. I know how old you are now. I'm talking about at the time. You got this internship.
It was a job.
Okay.
A regular job, but I was 18 at the time. And,
I guess you had long hair maybe because you were a druggie?
I did. Yeah. And I still swear that, John Shepherd was he was on the Board of Governors and Board of Trustees of the Mayo Clinic at the time, and he was president of the American Heart Association, and I have never seen him out of a three-piece suit. He was just kind of Mr. Clean. He was out of the country at the time. And the other doc that ran the lab, David Donald, he was an eccentric, brilliant scientist who had told me that he'd wake up in the middle of the night with these ideas, but he lived out in a little cabin in the woods near Byron, Minnesota, near Oxbow Park, and he's the one who hired me, and he always wore a white lab coat and had athletic tape wrapped around his shoes. He was this real eccentric guy, and I swear he played a joke on Shepherd by hiring me to be the lab technician.
Oh, that's hysterical. So I'm actually fascinated that you have taken that these guys were so instrumental in encouraging you that you were able to somehow turn this whole thing around, get your high school diploma, get to college, and then get to medical school. It really is. It's a crazy story.
It is. It is. I ended up going to 12-step meetings there in Rochester after working in the lab for a while and getting really serious about doing something, and I lasted 6 months, and at that time, people suggested you go once a week, and that's what I did, but then I missed one, and I'd been sober for 6 months. I felt better than I ever had in my life. Things were going fantastic, and I decided I didn't have to go every week for some reason, and I just didn't go 1 week, and I missed the meeting on Sunday, and on Monday, I was using again, and that was a point of absolute desperation, probably the lowest point in my life, because I thought that the only thing they told me would work when I went to treatment was 12-step meetings, and it didn't work either, basically. That's how I saw it at that point in time, and I'd been meaning to ask this guy to be my sponsor, and I hadn't done it. I actually didn't do much of anything. I showed up at those meetings, but I didn't do anything. I didn't work the steps. I didn't talk with people. I hardly talked at the meetings. I was really shy at the time and certainly had very little confidence. And I just did nothing but show up and lasted 6 months. And I went to this guy, John, and told him, you know, I went to treatment. That didn't work. I tried on my own. That didn't work. Now I've done this for 6 months and it doesn't work either. And I just don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm incapable of making it. And he, thank goodness, he said, Marv, you know, AA works just fine. You just haven't started. And he told me I needed to do the things I hadn't been doing. I had to talk at the meetings. I had to express myself and let people know who I really was. And I had to start looking at life a whole lot differently and starting to work those steps and talk with him. And that's what I did. And that made all the difference initially, just a huge difference. It gave me a path, a kind of a blueprint, and I started to do all of that and started to lead my life based on spiritual principles instead of just whatever I wanted to do. And that led to starting college. On my one-year anniversary in recovery, I walked into my first classroom at St. Olaf and met Jack Field, who set this up for us.
Yeah. That is just it's really remarkable. I mean, I've heard some great stories about recovery, but this one is just, it heads towards the top of the list for me. George, you would have to say the same, too. I mean, George has been sober 33 years?
Yes.
Yeah, so.
That's today, you know. Tomorrow's its own deal. But
I get that.
There's a couple things here I'm hearing, guys. Is in the recovery rooms, we hear that one of the promises is God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And a lot of times it's also, Billy, what we don't want to do for ourselves. And here's a guy that just takes this job. Okay, he's living out of his car, and all of a sudden he sees a couple guys he wants to be like. God brought these guys in his life, the job, I want to do this. So he stays sober for 6 months. He's working a program. He stops working the program. And I believe God allows us a lot of times to go our own way and get an immediate consequence. And instead of bagging the whole deal, he decides that he's going to go back, talk to some people, and here's what I'm going to do differently. And God leads him to get back in. He's going to college, and he meets a guy at the school that becomes a lifelong friend, and things are changing. And behind the scenes, God is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. And we don't usually see that until we look in the rearview mirror. And for me to hear that, Marv, this helps my recovery a lot, because a lot of times you hear, well, how'd you do it, Marv? Well, you go, yeah, you know, I did it, but behind the scenes, God was drawing me along. And it's remarkable to hear this.
Yeah, it was, you know, God drawing me along. It was God just setting the whole thing up. I can't make this story up. I mean, even when I went to St. Olaf just 1 year and then got married, actually, Linda and I, the girlfriend that my mom called to find me, and I have now been married 40 years, and we, you know, went off to college together at Drake after my first year at St. Olaf, because she was going to do art, and St. Olaf didn't offer that as a major. So we went down to Drake, and then when I started at Mayo, I applied to medical school, you know, really determined to get in throughout college. I worked very hard and did my share, but then when I made my application, one of the letters included in my application was from John Shepherd, another one from David Dow, the two guys in the lab. And John Shepherd had been named the Dean of Education of the Mayo Clinic just prior to my application to medical school. He was the boss of the Dean of the medical school at the time I applied. I was taken care of every step of the way.
That's amazing. the only thing that would top this for me, if it's possible, was that you had King Baby when you went to HCYF, if that's where you went.
I actually went right to Hazelden.
You did?
HCYF didn't exist at the time. Yeah, it was 1974 when I went to treatment, 1975 when I got sober. And so Hazelden up in Center City was the only place they didn't have HCYF or Pioneer House before it. And they put me on the old lodge, the original farmhouse at Hazelden, because they didn't know what to do with me. And I found out 5 years after I left that I was the first adolescent they ever treated. And I met the second guy the second adolescent ever treated is a guy named David, and he lives out in Sacramento. And we happened to meet years later, 20 years, 25 years later, because he actually works in the addiction field as well. And it turns out, although I was there first about several months before him, he stayed sober from the very beginning, and he's been sober longer than me, which is great.
Was Cunningham up at Hazelden then as a counselor?
I met Tom later.
Okay.
I don't know if he was there at that time. I just, you know, we were fairly well segregated at the time, and I don't remember him.
You know what's interesting to me, it is just an aside here, guys, is all the people God brought to Hazelden, and then they – you know, we always talk about, Marv, on this show, that God doesn't get us sober without a job to do. And I look at how God sent his people out, you know, just like the beginning of the recovery movement with two guys. And it's just overwhelming for me to look at that and see God's hand in all our lives, in the service, and, you know, the Cunninghams and the Selbys and Curtises, and, you know, you can go on, and it's amazing. And you, you know, here's his plan for you. He's going to help you get sober, but then you're going to go out and work with others, and it's just amazing to watch.
I would also say, Marv, if between college and medical school, you played for the Yankees, this interview is over. Because I couldn't take that.
No.
This is that would push me right to the end of my limits.
Yeah, you're close now.
I'm already. Say, yeah. You know how close I am to just calling this thing off right
yep.
now.
Yep.
Yeah.
You thought you had it going, and now you realize,
No, I got nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
Did you ever one day, George, think that you were going to be important? Because it happened to Marv.
Yeah, I'm hoping for it.
You're still hoping for it?
Well, nobody.
That ship has sailed, my friend.
Nobody recognizes the talent I have except me.
See the problems we have in the studio, Marv? It's unbelievable.
Oh, man.
So I'm just so curious now to hear of your journey to and your rise to the top. Because, George, we've climbed the mountain. We've got the guru sitting here. We can ask him anything we want.
You bet.
I mean, there's opioid addiction, there's all kinds of things going on, but where do you want to start?
Well, you know, the one thing, and we want to get to that, obviously, but in the bio that you're a professor for the Hazelden School of Addiction Studies, I guess it is, and I've had a lot of interns from that school, worked a little bit with Dr. Dan, who was before you, I think, up there, and just what a remarkable, you know, school this is, and sending out people, is that, you know, that's got to be just a fun part of your job, isn't it?
It really is. It's just great to be able to teach other people. And now, probably about half of our grad students in that addiction studies program are not in recovery. So they're being exposed to what addiction recovery is really all about during the course of their year or two while they're in the graduate school. And then about a half of them are in recovery, so they already have some exposure to it, and they're learning the kind of the factual and scientific aspects of addiction and its treatment. So when I get that chance to teach those people, it's just a blast. It is one of the most fun things I do. I really enjoy lecturing now to our patients, especially, but also our graduate students. They're young for the most part, but they actually they range all ages. I mean, there's people in their 60s and 70s in the grad school that are doing, you know, second jobs, that sort of thing, or second careers, or third or fourth even, and just giving back at some point in their life.
Marv, I would like to ask you a little bit about some of the misuse and addiction to painkillers that people have nowadays. What have we learned? What do we know? And just maybe there's just some information you can share with our listeners about just the addiction to painkillers nowadays.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's really become a big part of my professional life. And it all started with really bad information, mostly promulgated by the pharmaceutical industry. They supported some researchers, and, you know, physicians who suggested that the use of opioids for chronic pain, which is basically defined as pain that lasts more than 3 months, but opioids for chronic pain was okay, it was effective, and it was really safe, that people weren't going to become addicted, don't even worry about it. That was basically what docs were told starting in the mid-90s, and it changed a whole generation of physicians from what I was taught back in the 80s, that opioids are very dangerous for anybody. They are addictive, and you have to be extremely careful, especially for people with chronic pain, because when you take these things long-term, they're really powerful, they're addicting, and people have problems with them. That's what I was told. Well, that all shifts in the mid-90s, and until about 2015, we were teaching people what I described earlier, that they were safe even for addiction. Don't even worry about it. So we've got 20 years of physicians convinced that it's okay to provide these things and not even to worry about it, and that's what they did. And so we exposed millions of people to really addictive substances on a regular basis, and as a result, we had a remarkable increase in those with addiction, remarkable increase in emergency room admissions for opioid problems, mostly overdose, remarkable increase in those coming into treatment for opioid addiction, and this incredible and tragic increase in overdose death. We've never seen anything like it, although in the late 1800s, early 1900s in the United States, we didn't have laws governing opium. Opium was imported, and a similar thing happened. We exposed a major part of the population to opium, developed a whole bunch of opium addicts with all the problems associated with it, which resulted in all the laws that changed access to opium.
So the dilemma from the treatment side is, how do we treat this? And I know Hazelden has been at the cutting edge of this. How have you changed how you treat opioid addiction?
You know, we really had to change because a few things. One, we had so many more people coming into residential treatment, into our outpatient settings with opioid addiction. And in the residential setting, we've usually got 22, 24 people on a unit, either men or women. And when there were two or three people that had, you know, the opioid addiction, they'd come in and they'd do great. They'd fall right into the kind of positive peer culture that we try to, you know, establish on those units, and they'd get involved and they'd support each other and the rest of the people there and really have an optimistic, positive outlook. Well, when it got to be 8 or 10 people with opioid addiction, all of a sudden they started bonding negatively. It was as if they brought that street culture in with them. And we heard things like snitches get stitches, you know, telling an alcoholic who was trying to hold someone, a you know, younger person with opioid addiction accountable, snitches get stitches. And they were bringing drugs onto the units, and then rather than getting positive, they were trying to figure out how to get high while they were there, how to get out early. And we had about 25% of people leaving early that had opioid addiction, and that's always a bad outcome when people leave treatment early. And there was also the national data that revealed the death rate escalating, and we started to see an occasional death upon relapse when people left treatment, which is, you know, the worst of all possible outcomes, just horrible. When you send someone back out thinking they're getting back on the road to recovery and they relapse and die. So we decided we've got to do something more about this. We went to the literature on opioid addiction and its treatment, and what we found overwhelmingly was that a couple of medications were really effective in addition to what we were already doing. And since we weren't using those medications, we reviewed all that literature. We made decisions to go down that path and add the medications to our protocols for people with opioid addiction. But we also added groups just for them. So instead of being in groups with the alcoholics and methamphetamine and cocaine addicts and everybody else, at least once or twice a week, they got to go to their own group just for people with opioid use disorders. And that, the medications helped because they engage people in treatment. They make them much more comfortable quicker. They reduce craving. And that allows us to engage them in the treatment process and allows them to engage in recovery. And then changing those groups allowed them to start to support one another in the way that we'd expect anybody to, and it happened. It really happened when they were given that opportunity among themselves. Instead of bonding negatively, they started to bond positively. We started teaching them a lot about the dangers of opioid addiction, especially the overdose problem. Got them all naloxone, the antidote, so that when they leave, if they overdose, someone might grab it out of their pocket. Or when we've had people tell us, I saved someone else's life, an old friend who came over and he overdosed at my house, and I gave him naloxone. So we we focused on engagement and really long-term outpatient care. So we want them to stay involved long-term because the craving for opioids lasts a long time, months if not years.
So on the medications, do they take these the rest of their life? Or are they used to help get through the withdrawal and taper off?
You know, what we were, we have basically three groups of people with opioid addiction. One who refuses medication, a little under a third. They just don't want it at all. And so they, we use buprenorphine, one of the two medications, to detox them and get them off opioids. And they stop in, during treatment, and they're just going down that path without medication. Then about a third take the buprenorphine and stay on it as a maintenance medication, somewhat like methadone. So it's a lot safer than methadone in two ways. You can't really overdose on it by itself. You can overdose if you add other things. So it's a safer, and you, after a certain point, you can't get high from it. It's, there's something called a ceiling effect that, that if you keep using higher and higher doses, it doesn't do anything, and you get tolerant to it really rapidly. Actually, you're already tolerant to opioids if you're there starting it anyway, so it, you're just taking it to kind of prevent withdrawal and ease yourself into recovery. And then the third group is taking extended-release naltrexone, which blocks opioid receptors, and it's a once-a-month shot in the butt, and it lasts a month. And if you use opioids, they don't work because your receptors are blocked. They just, the heroin or oxycodone or whatever just can't bind to the receptors to cause intoxication. So those three options... the one, the buprenorphine, is a little controversial. Some treatment programs don't like it. They won't use it. They see it as just like methadone and scary in that regard that maybe people will abuse it or misuse it. And it's true that that can happen sometimes. We have people coming into our Plymouth program, the youth program that used to be called ACYF, and they say, you know, the first opioid I ever took was buprenorphine. I bought it on the street, and I took it, and I got high. And it's a powerful opioid. It will cause intoxication unless you use it regularly for a while, and then it doesn't.
Does it have a reverse tolerance if you stop and then you start using it again?
If you stop for a long enough period of time and start again, you still would get high again.
Okay. That was my addict question. I'm in recovery, too. So I just, you know, how we think. Well, no, you know, and guys I talk to on this, because, you know, I know the controversy, and, you know, yeah. What we look at is nothing's been working, okay? There's people dying, and I was working with a guy the other day, and I said, have a lot of your friends died? He goes, yeah, and I've died three times myself. And,
wow.
You know, I'm a... purist, but I'm also for not putting my program onto other people. I'm not that egotistical anymore, but it seems the fear of withdrawal and everything keeps a lot of people from getting help. So I'm for whatever works, and at a certain point, I think you got to provide what'll work for people. But frankly, anybody who says they know what's working, that's not true. We got a lot of people dying. I think we're making an impact, but you know, the perfect treatment isn't, we don't have it yet, right?
No, we don't, and we're making headway. We've got some research for six-month outcomes with this new program, and they're really good of all three groups, both medicines and the non-medicine group. And we were able to reduce that 25% of people leaving early down to 8%. They went from the worst group to the best group by changing our programming and using these medications. We don't expect them to stay on medication lifelong. The research shows most people stop anyway. We want to see them get into really solid recovery while they're on the medication, and then it's up to them and the people around them to say if they want to stay on it or not at that point. And, you know, most people are stopping the medication. A minor group are staying on it, but it's ultimately their own decision. I mean, it's always your own decision to take a medicine or not anyway.
Right.
And the truth is, you're right, so many people are dying. My bias is we have to do everything we can, independent of our philosophical, you know, differences, to help these people and keep them alive and get into recovery. So, you know, going back to my story and the influence of both science in that lab and the spirit in 12-step meetings, that's what I'm using now to try and figure out how to address this opioid crisis. Both those as much as possible, anything that works. I call it the kitchen sink method of addiction treatment, because we throw everything we can at people hoping something helps them out and keeps them engaged and keeps them sober.
Barb, let me ask you a question about the way doctors seem to dispense drugs like OxyContin. I had a friend who got a hip replacement surgery, and I saw her, you know, a couple, 3 weeks after it, and I said, "How's your pain level?" She goes, "Ah, it's okay. I'm doing pretty good." And I said, "Did you get any Oxy when, you know, you left the hospital?" And she goes, "Actually, I got my prescription filled before I left the hospital." I said, "Oh." I said, "How many did you get?" She said, "I got 80. And I thought, "What? How long would you want to be taking that after a surgical procedure? And what is some wise advice for someone that is going to be facing a surgical procedure? And how should they look at getting pain medication like Oxy, where they say, I don't want to get addicted to this, but I don't want to live with pain either?"
Yeah, it's really a quandary for folks in recovery, and it's essential to have other people involved in that. You know, let people know, get some good advice about it, because most doctors know nothing about the risk that people like us in recovery take after surgery taking those medications. And giving somebody 80 like that could be a death sentence, you know, that someone in recovery. So they are, in especially in orthopedics, they are recognizing the risks of opioids, and they've really reduced the number of medications, the number of opioids they'll hand out after surgery. So they're going down to the point that maybe 3 to 7 days is all you're going to get. But it's still not unusual to get the 80, 90 or more of these things at that point in time. So I've advised a lot of people throughout my career who knew me or knew of me and called and just said, "I'm going in for surgery. What should I do?" And what I say is, you know, talk to your doctor. Let them know that this is extremely risky for you, that you are in recovery and you have to be really careful with these medications, and ask them to provide a distinct prescription for only the amount they think is absolutely necessary, and agree to only take it exactly as prescribed, and ask the doctor not to use any sort of ranges, not one or two every 4 to 6 hours. That's the last thing we need in recovery, is to make any kind of decision about the use of that medication. Because if it says one or two every 4 to 6, I may be tempted to take 2 every 4 and then 4 every 2. You know, I'm starting to make those decisions myself. And so I tell the people to ask the doctor, I'll talk with their doctor, which I've done as well, and I'll tell them, you know, write it out for what you think the normal patient, average patient would need, 2 tablets every 4 hours for the first 2 days. And don't vary from the prescription. Just do it exactly as prescribed. Have somebody else in your life, whether it's a spouse or a real good friend or somebody, a sponsor, involved in how you're taking it. And so you're talking about that as well, and other people know what you're doing, so that there's no secrets about this, because that gets us into trouble really fast, too. I'm taking this medicine. I might actually feel something from it. I might not. It might just relieve pain without me even noticing, or it might make me sick as a dog and I can't stand it, but it's still a risk. And having other people involved makes all the difference in the world, and letting those docs know exactly how to do it and limiting it to just enough until we can change over to, you know, non-addicting medicines like ibuprofen or something really early on, and just shift over. I had my first surgery in recovery when I turned 50, and my primary care doc, he knew that I'm in recovery. We talked about it a lot over the years, and so I told him I'm worried about post-op pain and what they're going to do. So I talked to the surgeon, told him I'm in recovery. He said, oh, don't worry about it. And I knew he knew nothing about addiction when he said that. I talked to the anesthesiologist after talking to one of my best friends who's an anesthesiologist, who's not in recovery, but we've known each other since medical school. He told me, you know, tell the anesthesiologist that you really want this done in this order, these two medicines in this order. They're the most common ones used. If you do it in this order, you won't remember anything. And so even if you feel it, you won't know it. So we did that, but I still woke up to a prescription of 90 Vicodin, even though I expressed my concern. I took it home. I took one at bedtime the first night. I took one in the middle of the night, and that was it. 88 left, which I could have relapsed, it could have killed me, whatever. In my household, it disappeared. My wife took care of it. It was gone the next day when I said I didn't need any more. And that's how it should be. We are at too high a risk in recovery to take any chances with these really powerful medications.
Yeah, just thinking, I went through this thing this year. I had half a lung taken out, and, you know, I've been sober 33 years or whatever, right? Told everybody in the hospital I'm chemically dependent. And what you talked about, I wish I had talked to you before I went in. I was in the position of making the decision whether I took something. And, okay, the first day I took them, and then I started hallucinating. And then, of course, being mentally well-wrapped, I thought people were trying to kill me. So I needed to get out of there. And anyway, I wound up talking to the doctor afterwards a few days later, and I said how hard it was because I was refusing the meds when I needed them because I felt like I had relapsed. You know, I was in an altered state. And he said, do you have anybody you could talk to? I said, you mean like a guy that's been sober 30 years as a counselor that worked at Hazelden, Fairview University? He goes, that guy would be perfect. I said, well, that guy's me. And I said, I think the problem is, yeah, he laughed too, is I think what they don't get, and I didn't go to medical school. I don't slam doctors because I really respect it. I take the pill. It doesn't get me physically addicted, but it lights the scoreboard again. And I've had doctors say, I'll give you this.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you enough to get addicted. And what they don't realize is, one, charged it. Did I like them? Yeah. I was in a lot of pain, but I still got buzzed. I'm an addict.
Yep.
And so what you said's right. I told them that I think the doctors need to go, here's what you're going to take, whether you want to or not. This...
Yep.
You know, if I've got an input in the matter, oh boy. So I think that is a problem, and I don't think they realize that the psychological effect is just as strong as the physical addiction. You know, I want to use. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, Mark? I have a friend who had to have surgery, and he's in recovery long term, you know, over 30 years, and he called it a freebie because he got to have opioids, and
yep.
He was an opioid addict. And he did everything else that I described and was really safe about it. But just that attitude that I get a freebie is scary, you know, because you get a buzz and you're thinking it's a freebie. All of a sudden, you know, you might just take two and then three and then four and you're off and running.
No, it's, you know, what I learned is it doesn't get better. You know, I'm still me. And there's a part of me that's always going to want to use. I've got to turn that over to God and get other people in and go, hey, help me with this. You take the pills. And so that was great advice. Thank you. You know, I see this a lot, as I'm sure you do, and we see guys that are doing really well. They go in for kidney stones or something, and they get the, you know, Percocets or whatever. And they take one, and one works good, two's going to work better, and then it's over.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And they're gone. And I've actually seen, you know, deaths as a result of such a thing like that. Just a guy in recovery, surgery, suddenly, boom, you know, overdose on whatever.
Yep.
Just frightening. I also knew a guy, he was a dentist, and he came to me because... He was sanctioned by the dental board, and he had to see somebody to continue to work. But he was able to work. He was a good dentist. But he was trying to, he was alcoholic and trying to stay sober, and he had to have his own dental work, a pretty painful procedure. And I told him exactly the same thing we were just discussing. Take the medicine just as prescribed. Don't worry about it. Just take it and talk to someone. Make sure you got support, all of that. Well, he decided, screw it, and threw the prescription for the opioids away as he walked out of the office. There's a late afternoon appointment that he had this done. He said, I'm not going to take these medications. I'm just too scared to do it. I don't need them. So, and he's a dentist, right? So he thought he knew. No. So he gets home, and the pain's getting worse and worse. It gets to be about 10 o'clock at night, and he can't get the prescription because he tossed it. And it is excruciating. So he went and grabbed a bottle of booze and started drinking. And he numbed the pain, but he also undermined his, you know, his whole recovery and his career right in that moment.
Wow, these are tough stories.
Well, you know, Bill, I always, you know, Marv, when I hear the story like that, the shame that comes with the reality that you relapsed, I don't think you can realize that until you've gone through it. And, you know, I was 7 years in and out. You said you had 6 months. The horror that you actually did, the one thing that you're committed to not doing, is so devastating.
It sure is.
And so when I hear that, it just, it makes me sad, but it happens every day. And this is so much bigger than we are. We have to go to God with it. Mm-hmm. And God brings people in like he did in your life to get you where, you know, you are. But you got to be looking for him in a constant vigilance, staying sober. So...
Yeah, yeah. And Marv is a big success, George. I hate to keep bringing that up in front of you, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, Marv, you should feel as bad about it as I do.
Marv, do you have a corner? Do you have a corner office with a nice view? I'm just asking.
Yeah,
do you?
I don't really. I got kind of a little office. It's a good office.
Okay. George and I would like to come to that office. Put our feet up on your desk and take selfies.
That'd be great.
Are you cool with that?
Come on by. Absolutely.
Are you there now, Marv?
That's almost creepy, George.
Yeah, it is. We're kind of free. Yeah, we're free tonight. So,
Marv, thank you so much for being on the show. It's just been so nice to meet you and interesting to hear your story. It's actually one of the most fascinating stories I've ever heard.
You bet. It is. That's remarkable.
Well,
thanks for your service to everybody, too.
No kidding.
You didn't just take this thing and say, thank you very much, I'm out of here. You know, you're giving back and helping a lot of people. That's great.
Well, 2 years into medical school, I was still planning to be a cardiac surgeon because of the influence of the guys in that lab.
Wow.
I saw all these people with addiction in the hospitals on my clinical rotations. And we weren't identifying addiction, we weren't referring them for treatment, we weren't getting consults, doing nothing. And I was going to my meeting every week and talking about this and complaining about it. And after a few weeks of this, two docs in my AA meeting took me aside and said, you know, Marv, you got to quit bitching about this and do something about it. And it opened my eyes to possibility, and I chose to go into addiction instead of become a surgeon. And that's how it all started.
Well, Marv, we're going to have you back on the show whether you like it or not.
Good deal.
Okay,
well, I really
good.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Bill and George.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marv.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com. Softly.